This is Fresh Air. Tom Friedman says he's learned from experience that a Jew who wants to make a career working in the Middle East will always be a lonely man. He will never be fully accepted or trusted by the Arabs, and he will never be fully accepted or trusted by the Jews. While reporting from the Middle East, Friedman found that if you have any credibility, everyone wants to own you, and if they can't own you, they want to destroy you. But Friedman says he's continuing to try to bear witness and think independently. Friedman has reported from Lebanon and Israel for the New York Times and won 2 Pulitzers for his work. He's also the author of the best-selling book, From Beirut to Jerusalem. I spoke with Tom Friedman earlier today about the war. I asked him if his emotions and his politics were at odds.
I feel that I'm an everyman when I approach this war, in the sense that I'm deeply ambivalent about it. And I've always felt since the beginning of this war that the ambivalence in this war isn't like half of Americans are against it and half are for it, but that half of each of us is for it and half of each of us is against it. On the one hand, I identify very deeply with the idea of the United States stopping a ruthless dictator armed with weapons of mass destruction, which can, to begin with, threaten people in the Middle East who share our values, and if not stopped, one day maybe even threaten us. But the other half of me is ambivalent because I have a hard time imagining myself or my friends or any fellow American dying to restore the Emir of Kuwait to his throne, dying to protect societies that don't allow women to drive, and trying to make the world safe for feudalism. And so I'm torn between those two impulses.
You're reporting from Washington now. You had spent years in Beirut and in Jerusalem. Is Washington the place you want to be now?
Oh, now you're really asking a tough question. You know, for me, going from the Middle East to Washington as a reporter is like going from covering a street to covering a hall. And to going from covering a drama unfolding before your very eyes to covering a policy that's invisible. I mean, what is the you can't say, I met the policy today, it wept on my shoulder. Or I saw the policy bleeding outside the C Street entrance of the State Department. So there is a certain kind of bloodless quality, and I don't mean that I enjoy the blood, I mean an emotionless quality to Washington reporting that I find very frustrating. And the other thing that one finds frustrating in Washington is there are all these experts and government officials who, for whom the world out there is very neat. They have all their plans and their policy papers. And I have a much healthier respect for what I would call the wild earth, and maybe for the unpredictable nature of the Middle East.
So here you are in Washington now. From what angles are you trying to investigate the story of the war?
Well, really what I'm trying to think of right now, because I'm not a military correspondent and there's not much work these days for diplomatic correspondents, but what I'm trying to think about now is to answer really a very simple question. How will we know when we've won? What will be the ingredients of any victory? And a lot of the thrust of my reporting is to try to probe that with people. What will victory look like? How will we know when we've won?
Tom Friedman is my guest, reporter for the New York Times. He reported from Lebanon and from Israel for many years, and he's the author of the best-selling book, From Beirut to Jerusalem. Whether linkage is a part of our policy or not, it's impossible to talk to anyone in the Middle East, Arab or Israeli, without Israel-Arab relations and Israeli-Palestinian relations coming up. I'd like you to help us sort through some of the reasons why and some of the reasons for the deep distrust between Arabs and Israelis in the Middle East.
Well, let me turn your question around slightly and try to answer a question that really has been posed to me quite frequently, and I hear officials not talking about, and that is, what will be the opportunities after this war for Arab-Israeli and Palestinian-Israeli negotiations? Will they be improved or will they not? And I think right now we see events pulling in two different directions. On the Israeli-Palestinian front, what I would say is that long after Israelis forget the chill that went down their spine when they heard the air raid sirens go off, and long after they forget the thud of the Scud missiles landing in Tel Aviv, they will remember the applause of the Palestinians. The applause of Palestinians at the rockets that Saddam Hussein was firing into Israel. And that is something that is going to fundamentally affect for a very long time Israeli attitudes towards the Palestinians and the whole peace process question. In the 2 years, 3 years really, previous to this war, enormous progress had been made on the part of the PLO and Palestinians in convincing Israelis that what they were out for was their own state. And the difference between them and Israelis should be where the border is, not over the question of existence. And we saw that with the Intifada. We saw that with Arafat's declaration in Geneva. I would say the Palestinian response to the Iraqi Scud attacks on Israel, the fact that not a single Palestinian leader of a local level or a national level has stood up and condemned those attacks, has wiped out everything positive that might have been achieved in the last 2 years. Now, the more positive side of that, if there is one, is the fact that certainly several Arab regimes, Saudi Arabia, the Gulf states and whatnot, even Syria to some extent, are now aligned with the United States in a confrontation with another Arab state. They are effectively or tacitly in the same trench with the Israelis. You could watch on CNN many nights, Scuds coming into Tel Aviv and Scuds coming into Dahran, Saudi Arabia. And it is at least conceivable in the minds of some that after this war, there will be certainly a greater willingness of some of these Arab states to entertain the idea of a peace agreement or a greater recognition of Israel. And that once the Israelis are reassured about some of their concerns from the surrounding Arab states, maybe they might feel more secure about making overtures to the Palestinians. I personally am rather dubious about this, and I'm not sure that what we're seeing in the Gulf War can necessarily be extrapolated to the peace process.
You know, we've spoken to on this program several Palestinians who live in America or who live in the occupied territories. And when I ask about this cheering for the Scud missiles, what I'm told is, well, you know, what do you expect to happen? Palestinians in the occupied territories are living virtually under house arrest with a 24-hour curfew. Palestinians have suffered many deaths and even more arrests during the three-year intifada. What kind of response would you expect them to have?
Well, that reminds me of the line out of West Side Story where the Sharks and the Jets say to Officer Krupke, we're depraved on account of we're deprived. At what point do people begin to take a moral stand? I mean, what I would say to that is that, look, there are certain power realities in the Middle East, okay? The reality of the Israeli-Palestinian balance of power is that the balance of power is far greater in Israel's favor. Now, given that reality, you can do, if you're Palestinians, it seems to be one of two things. You can confront that power reality with a superior power, or you can resign yourself to that superior power and try to deal with it diplomatically. But what I see the Palestinians doing is not being able to muster enough power to change Israel's behavior, and at the same time not being ready to state diplomatically what might be required to bring the Israelis along. This is not a charity game out there. I mean, no one's going to give the Palestinians anything because they've been deprived of something. It's not in the nature of the neighborhood. There was no charity for the Jews. There'll be none for the Palestinians.
My guest is New York Times reporter Tom Friedman. He's the author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. More with Friedman after this short break. This is Fresh Air. Tom Friedman is my guest, reporter for the New York Times. He was for many years stationed in Lebanon, then in Jerusalem, and he's the author of the best-selling book From Beirut to Jerusalem. Just a couple of days ago, Sari Nasebe was arrested. He lives in the occupied territories. He's a Palestinian. And he was arrested for allegedly passing on locations of Scud missile strikes to Iraqis. Now, he's generally considered among the most eloquent voices in the Palestinian peace process, a moderate voice. You spoke very highly of him in Beirut to Jerusalem. You described him as having incredible insight and honesty. I wonder what your reaction was to his arrest.
I think it's outrageous. I know Sari Nusaybe, and without even knowing any of the facts of this case, I'd be ready to state categorically that the idea that he is somehow spying for the Iraqis is utterly ludicrous. I think the fact that he has been put under administrative detention, in which the Israelis don't then have to bring him to trial, in other words, don't have to introduce any evidence at all against him, but can simply say, we are arresting him for these reasons, we're locking him up for 6 months, and under these conditions, shows how little evidence they actually have against him. I think what they are afraid of is precisely that someone like Sari will break this wall of silence that Palestinians have imposed on themselves in terms of condemning the Iraqi Scud attacks on Israel, that he will step out, speak out against these attacks, and serve as maybe the forerunner of some kind of future Israeli-Palestinian peace process. And I think the arrest of Sari, who's probably the most articulate and leading Palestinian advocate for a two-state solution, Israeli-Palestinian state, based on mutual recognition. His arrest, I think, is very revealing and very sad.
The PLO is in the Iraqi camp ostensibly because of how they were, this is the way Palestinians describe it, that the Palestinians are in the Iraqi camp ostensibly because of how they were sold out by the United States and Israel after Arafat agreed to recognize Israel's right to exist and negotiate. And then Secretary of State George Shultz authorized dialogue with the PLO, and it fell apart. And many people have said Arafat was kind of humiliated for his agreement to recognize Israel. Does that sound like a reasonable explanation to you? Is that the way you understand it?
Sounds really like nonsense to me. Let's go back to the Intifada, the Palestinian uprising. Why was it important? What was sort of different and unique about it? Why did it capture the imagination even of Israelis in the beginning? It's because the Palestinians, through the Intifada, introduced really a new method and a new message vis-a-vis the Israelis. The new method was relatively non-lethal mass civil disobedience, the use of stones and civil disobedience as opposed to terrorism, hijacking, guerrilla warfare, call it whatever you will. In other words, they really tried to make life miserable for the Israelis, but not necessarily dangerous. That was at least the theoretical approach. And I'm not saying that they didn't engage in more serious violence, but I'm saying that was the underlying theory. Now, at the same time, they combined that with a new message, and the new message was no longer, when it comes to the question of recognizing Israel, saying, well, yes, no, maybe, and speaking out of both sides of their mouths, but with Arafat explicitly recognizing Israel at his press conference in Geneva in December 1988. Now, what the Palestinians didn't realize is that with those two initiatives, they were at stage one in their effort to achieve a Palestinian state in this new method and new message. But they had to get to stage 10. You can't just, in one press conference in Geneva, insert the word Israel in one sentence and expect that Israelis are going to roll over and say, oh my God, after 20 years, I mean, Arafat said the word Israel one time in one sentence, please, here, Yasser, take the West Bank and half of Jerusalem too. It's got to be a process. It's something you've got to build on. It's something you've got to cultivate. Now, do the Palestinians have reason to complain that even what Arafat did was not even met with a parallel gesture from the Israeli government? Absolutely. But then the response, it seems to me, should not be to say, okay, well, we tried, we said it one time, now we're taking our ball and going home because this isn't fair. There's no fairness, okay? Then you've got to redouble your efforts. You've got to redouble your methods of civil disobedience, and you've got to redouble your message of recognizing Israel. And by slipping the word Israel one time in one sentence into Geneva, just ain't going to do it.
My guest is New York Times reporter Tom Friedman. He's the author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem. More with Friedman in 60 seconds. This is Fresh Air. Tom Friedman is my guest, reporter for the New York Times, and author of the best-selling book From Beirut to Jerusalem. And he reported for many years from both cities for the New York Times. He's now based in Washington, D.C. You're thinking a lot about what peace might look like in the Middle East after the war is over. Do you have any scenarios you'd like to suggest to us about what you'd like to see happen?
Well, let me tell you, my overarching feeling is that we should be limiting our objectives right now and not widening them. I've always believed that, you know, this war is about stopping Saddam Hussein. Okay, this is about catching a thief, essentially. If you've seen the movie The Godfather, then you can understand what this war is about. Saddam Hussein came to the Kuwaitis and made them an offer they couldn't refuse, and they refused. So he engaged in the international equivalent of a kneecapping. He engaged in the world's biggest bank job. And having done that, he called up the Saudis and said to King Fahad, "King Fahad, you live in such a beautiful house. You have so many beautiful oil wells in your backyard. It would be a shame if there were a fire here. But you know what? It's your lucky day, because I, Saddam Hussein, am selling fire insurance. And for only $2 billion a month, I will ensure there will be no fire here." And King Fahad called George Bush and said, "Look, I got this mafioso down the street. He's trying to sell me fire insurance, and he's crazy, and he likes to play with matches." And George Bush said, "Look, we will be the cops. Don't buy the insurance." So this is not about a new world order in the Middle East. This is about law and order, okay? I get very frightened when I hear the president talking about healing the wounds of the Middle East, establishing a new order. Look, this is an old part of the world. It's very old clay. You can't build a new order out of it, okay? The people out there haven't had therapy, okay? That everyone's, you know, suddenly ready to the lamb to lie down with the lion. So what I say is, let's do the job we set out to do, reestablish some law and order, and then let's get out and come home.
Are you afraid that we won't get out and come home afterwards?
Yeah, I am afraid of that.
What does that picture look like?
Well, you know, one of the things I learned in covering the Israeli invasion of Lebanon is that it's a lot easier for a superior military force to enter into a country than it is to get out of that country and still preserve your gains. I mean, the Israelis invaded Lebanon in the summer of 82. They cut through the PLO and the Lebanese like a hot knife through butter. But when they wanted to get out and still preserve the gains that they had made through their military might, it became much more difficult. What I worry about is that we do engage in a ground war, and we do liberate Kuwait. And then what happens if the Iraqis still send Scud missiles into Israel, or they still shell us from Basra, from the Iraqi side of the border? Do we then occupy Basra? And if we occupy Basra, and they shell us from Baghdad? So I'm very worried about this sort of perpetual war of attrition.
Say we did what you wanted. You know, we went in, we restored the status quo and came home. Well, the status quo is incredible instability in a lot of ways in the Middle East. And the status quo is filled with deep hostilities. So you're kind of back where you started in a lot of ways, with the exception that, you know, Iraq is a lot weaker and maybe Saddam Hussein is out of power.
I'm afraid, Terry, in my mind, that's about all we can hope for. We can hope for a reasonably stable balance of power in which neither side or none of the sides will feel it has an incentive, militarily speaking, to attack the other. The idea of arms control in the Middle East, I was reading about that this morning, strikes me as insane. I mean, the idea that you could have arms control in the Middle East, I mean, you know, it's like arms control in the Wild West. I mean, who's going to trust anybody here? How can you have arms control between Israel and Syria when Syria is much worried about Iraq and Turkey as it is about Israel? I mean, there are just too many variables here. You got too many unstable chemicals. I have very, very low expectations for this part of the world. All I hope for is stable balances of power in this wilderness of tigers, so that none of the tigers will have an incentive to devour anyone else. But healing, therapy, that we all learn to love and live with each other, it just isn't in the nature of the neighborhood.
Tom Friedman, I want to thank you very much.
Thank you.
Tom Friedman is a reporter for The New York Times and author of the bestseller From Beirut to Jerusalem.